Way back in 2003, after many years of hard work and study, I passed the California bar exam at the age of 26. The exam was incredibly tough, a grueling, months-long marathon of stress, self-doubt, and all-night study sessions that sometimes felt more like a test of endurance and willpower than my accumulated legal knowledge. I barely maintained a social life, spending countless late nights poring over case law, statutes, and practice questions. And I put everything into those study sessions, so when I found out that I passed, it was a moment of pure, unadulterated joy. And the next several days felt like one big party. I still had to apply to join the California Bar Association, but compared to passing the exam, that would be a relatively simple process. And after all my hard work had paid off, I figured that I deserved a little celebration. I organized get-togethers with family and friends, drank a lot of fancy champagne in some very fancy restaurants, and caught up on about 9 months of backed-up sleep deprivation. It was one of the highest points of my entire life, but it was quickly followed by one of the lowest. Just over a week after passing the bar, I was due to meet my mom for lunch. We'd been a single-parent household ever since my dad passed away when I was in my teens, and my younger brother, who still lived with her at her place, was set to join us for lunch that day. It wasn't like either of them to be late without good reason, so I tried calling each of their cell phones. And then, as calls to each of them went unanswered, I got this creeping feeling that something was wrong. I remember apologizing to the waitress before leaving the restaurant, then just as I got to my car, my brother called with the single worst piece of news I've ever received. They'd been getting ready to come meet me when Mom had suddenly collapsed. My brother had called 911, the ambulance had arrived within minutes, and she was rushed into surgery when they arrived at the hospital. But sadly, and I heard my brother's heart break as he forced himself to tell me, Mom hadn't made it. We later found out it was a catastrophic brain aneurysm, one of the worst the doctors had ever seen, and the only comfort being that she died very suddenly and didn't suffer too much. And that news destroyed us. My brother and I could barely keep ourselves together, with our grandpa and a paternal aunt having to step in to organize Mom's funeral on an estate. I went from sipping champagne in celebration to downing cheap vodka to keep lucidity at bay, and when I finally put down the bottle, sobriety awakened a kind of existential crisis in me. One moment I'd been basking in achievement, feeling like I'd conquered the world. Then, life went ahead and reminded me just how little control I really had. I'd spent years chasing the bar. It had come to define me. But what was the point of all that hard work if life could just pull the rug out from under you? It seemed really ironic. I'd worked my butt off to pass that bar, and then when I finally did it, I didn't know if I even wanted it anymore. I didn't know how to reconcile the triumph with the crushing reality that the person that I most wanted to share it with was gone. One thing which made that period of time particularly difficult was how no one in my legal circles got word of Mom's passing. I was enduring the most heartbreak of my entire life, and I was getting congratulative texts and emails from friends and mentors who sometimes asked if I wanted to meet up to celebrate. I didn't even want to get out of bed, let alone celebrate, and I felt horribly ungrateful saying this, but at the time, their praise and compliments felt almost meaningless. I was obviously in a very dark place, but I was also self-aware enough to recognize that if I didn't do something about it, if I didn't get away from the city with all its unhealthy methods of grief management, I was headed for disaster. I needed to get away. To be alone with my thoughts someplace that I could process things in my own time. And then, after a little soul-searching and a brief look online, I found what I believed was the solution. In a lot of America's national parks, way out in the middle of nowhere, there are these big old structures named fire towers. They're not all towers. Some of them are just strategically placed single-story cabins, but they're all located on ground high enough to survey the surrounding area, and they're occupied seasonally by long-term Forest Service employees called fire lookouts. A fire lookout's job is to watch for wildfires, lightning strikes, and other fire risks from their vantage point, and they spend long hours scanning the landscape for smoke or flames, using binoculars and maps to pinpoint locations. When they spot something, They reported to dispatchers with details like coordinates and weather conditions, who in turn guide firefighters towards the smoke and flames. And from what I read, it was solitary work, requiring a lot of focus and a lot of patience. The living quarters seemed pretty Spartan too, if you know what I mean. But those headstrong enough to volunteer themselves provided a valuable service to both the environment and their fellow citizens. And from that moment on that I first read about it, I was captivated. I couldn't think of a more perfect way to spend the summer than in some solitary perch out in the great American wilderness, surrounded by nothing but green leaves, blue skies, and the untamed tranquility of nature. I imagined myself in one of those remote towers, watching for smoke on the horizon, with my only masters being a notebook and a radio. It felt like a way to escape, a way to maybe find some peace amid the chaos of my grief. But getting the job wasn't as simple as packing a bag and heading out into the woods. Fire lookout positions, especially in a place like Oregon with its vast forests and history of wildfires, proved surprisingly tough to secure. First, I had to research where to apply, and then, after digging through listings that had already been closed, I found a posting for a summer gig in the Umatilla National Forest in northeastern Oregon. And the process was pretty straightforward, but the Forest Service demanded a high standard from its applicants. I had to submit a resume and a cover letter, each tailored to demonstrate that I could handle both the isolation and the responsibility. My law background didn't directly apply, but I leaned on my ability to work independently, highlighted my attention to detail honed by my legal research, and assured them that I wasn't nuts. I also had to prove that I was physically fit enough for the job, since some towers require hiking in with supplies or dealing with basic maintenance. I had to get certified in basic first aid, which I squeezed into a weekend course, and I was subjected to a background check, and I even had to complete online modules on wildfire detection and radio communication protocols. And the Forest Service wanted people who could spot a plume of smoke from miles away, report it accurately, and stay calm under pressure. And so I studied maps of the region, learned the basics of topography, and brushed up on how to use a firefinder, which is a tool lookouts use to pinpoint a fire's location. There was a phone interview, too, where they grilled me on how I'd handle my weeks of solitude, spotty cell service, and the occasional bear sighting, and I told them that I needed the solitude as much as they needed someone reliable. And then, after a couple of anxious weeks of waiting, I got the call that I'd been accepted. They assigned me to a tower for the summer, starting in June, and sent me a packet with information on how to get there, what to bring, and a very stern warning about the lack of running water or electricity. It was rough, but I guess that was kind of the point. I wanted to strip everything down to the basics, to sit with my thoughts and my loss, and maybe find a way to make peace with it all. Driving out to the Table Rock lookout was an adventure in itself as I drove out into the wild heart of northeastern Oregon. From Dayton, I took the North Touche Road, the road climbing steadily with green rolling hills on either side as I cut through the Blue Mountains, and the air cooled as the elevation ticked up and the landscape opens into the sweeping view that stretched toward the horizon. And when I arrived, I parked at the base of the lookout. It was kind of a boxy structure, perched on a 10-foot concrete base that had first been constructed in 1949, before being upgraded with metal shutters and weatherproof siding in the late 80s. I saw the forest ranger that I was set to meet as I rolled in. It was an older guy in a green uniform with this very sun-weathered face who had driven up to give me the rundown. He walked me around the site while pointing out all the essentials. There was the outhouse, sort of modernized version with a chemical toilet, the propane stove, the radio for reporting smoke, and, most importantly, the Osborne firefinder. As we climbed the steps into the cab, a snug 14x14 living space with windows on all sides, the ranger took me through the daily log. He told me that I'd either get used to the quiet, or it'd drive me crazy. Then, with a smile and a handshake, he handed me the keys, wished me luck, and then took off the road in his truck. Daily life as a fire lookout settled into a quiet but steady rhythm, with mornings starting with coffee brewed on the propane stove. Then I'd step outside onto the catwalk, binoculars in hand, and scan the 360-degree panorama. West to the Columbia Basin, south to the snow-capped Wallawas, and on clearer days I could even see all the way into Idaho, to the Seven Devils about 80 miles east. As the morning progressed into the afternoon, I'd occupy myself by performing my duties and ensuring the cab and equipment were in good working order. But aside from that, it was a whole lot of nothing with just me, myself, and I. There were a lot of good upsides, the solitude, the sunsets, the ceiling of stars at night. But after a while, the challenges started to reveal themselves in earnest. The isolation proved as much a burden as it was a good. Going days without hearing another voice made my thoughts just loop endlessly, which sometimes made it feel like I was compounding my grief by depriving myself of those who actually understood. No running water meant hauling jugs up from my car, and the lack of electricity left me reliant on a battery-powered lantern during what proved to be some very spooky nights. The weather was a constant wild card, too. Lightning storms sometimes rolled through with this terrifying fury, with one threatening to spark a fire just over the ridge. And on top of all of that, the monotony of scanning the same vistas hour after hour started to wear down my focus. But still, the job's simplicity kept me grounded and brought a great deal of peace. At least until one day when I experienced what I can only describe as the most bizarre and terrifying experience of my entire life. It was mid-afternoon on a very dry and hazy day. I was on the catwalk, binoculars pressed to my eyes, sweeping the forested slopes below for any telltale wisps of smoke. My routine scans had become second nature by that point, but as I panned across a clearing about 2 miles downhill, something caught my eye. A lone, upright figure moving steadily through the trees. At first, I just thought it was a trick of the light, maybe a deer standing upright. It is a thing, look it up. But as I continued to track that shape through the binoculars, I realized the style of walking was unmistakably human. A lone hiker or camper wasn't unheard of out there, even at 6,250 feet. People venture into the backcountry all the time for all sorts of different reasons. But even so, I lowered the binoculars, rubbed my eyes, and raised them again to confirm. The figure was still there, maybe a mile and a half out now, heading southeast. A dark silhouette threading between the pines, and their walk was very unhurried, but deliberate. Usually speaking, a lone hiker wouldn't be anything for me to worry about. But in that moment, something just kept nagging me. I walked back into the cabin, grabbed my radio, then after informing Ranger HQ of the hiker's sighting, I asked them to confirm the status of the area. And the response crackled back after a brief pause, and this is really my best recollection of what was said.
Base to Table Rock, copy that. Be advised your sector is under evacuation orders as of 0800 this morning. Fire weather spiking, red flag warnings in effect, and we've got active burns 20 miles southeast and moving with the wind. If you can make contact, instruct them to evac immediately. Nearest road access is Forest Road 64, about 3 miles from their position. Over.
I told the ranger that I understood, but as I did so, I felt my stomach drop. Wildfires had been a looming threat all week, with dry lightning and gusty winds keeping firefighting crews on edge. But that was the first time it felt real, and the idea of someone hiking out there, oblivious to the danger, dragged me from my usual detachment. I had to warn them. But how? I swung the binoculars back towards that figure, and he was just a speck by then, but still visible weaving through a stand of pines. Yelling wouldn't really carry a mile and a half through the wind. I had no megaphone, and even if they were carrying a radio, I had no idea what frequency to reach them on. I grabbed the firefinder, aligned it with his position, and jotted the coordinates. I then bolted down the tower's steps to my car. I kept a whistle and an air horn in the glove box for emergencies, so once I was back on the catwalk, I blasted the air horn in 3 sharp bursts and then followed with a piercing blast from my whistle. Through the binoculars, I saw them pass. They'd heard it. And I started waving my arms wildly, uselessly shouting evacuate into the wind, and then fired off another trio of sharp bursts from that horn. The hiker hesitated, then shifted course slightly, angling westward what I'd hoped would be Forest Road 64. I radioed HQ again, informed them that I'd made some noise contact, and updated them on the hiker's change in direction. But then, in order to ascertain if the hiker had safely made their way out of the area, I asked HQ if they could send a patrol to intercept them. This was standard practice in Umatilla, as fire lookouts can't exactly go abandoning their post every time they see something unusual. I'd been specifically instructed to request a patrol should an event like that arise, but HQ's response left me stunned. They told me,
"Negative, Table Rock. Cannot dispatch to FR 64. Can you make it out to his position? Over."
It was easily one of the most loaded questions I'd ever been asked, because it was either a case of I make it out to the hiker's position to make sure that they were evacuating, or potentially condemn an oblivious hiker to a very slow and agonizing death. The fires were still around 20 miles off, but with a red flag warning, that could change very quickly. It was down to me to make sure that the hiker was evacuating, or I could potentially have their death on my conscience for the rest of my life. And when I thought of it like that, it was an easy decision to make. I grabbed my pack from the cabin, which was already stocked with water, a first aid kit, and a map and a radio, and then threw in the air horn and whistle for good measure. I clipped my binoculars to my belt, put on my hiking boots, and then jotted down a quick entry that said, 1530, leaving post to locate individual southeast of position. We'll report back. I locked the cab, took one last scan of the horizon, then started down the steps, bypassing my car when I reached the bottom. The first half mile was drivable, but beyond that, I'd be on foot anyway, and time in that situation mattered. I set off southeast on foot, following the bearing that I'd locked in with the firefinder. The descent was steep at first, with a plateau dropping into a slope of loose rock that crunched and shifted precariously under my feet. Where I could, I stuck to game trails that I'd explored previously, weaving through clumps of brush as the wind carried a faint heat that made my skin prickle. I brought the binoculars up to my eyes every so often, scanning ahead for movement, but the forest was very dense out there, and without my vantage point, visibility was patchy at best. And after about 15 to 20 minutes of speed hiking, I hit a shallow draw, the terrain leveling off into a mix of open meadows and dense timber. I figured that he might still be a mile out, maybe less if he kept his pace, so I blew these three sharp blasts with my whistle, but got nothing in response. And I pushed on, following the draw southeast by hiking along the dry creek bed littered with rocks. My boots sank into pine needles as sweat beaded down my forehead, and every few hundred yards, I stopped to scan with the binoculars, glassing the ridge lines and gaps in the trees. And at one point, a mule deer bolted from a thicket, which scared me a lot more than I'd care to admit. And almost as a way of steadying myself, I radioed HQ to let them know that I was en route, but hadn't made contact yet. They acknowledged and urged me to stay safe, and then I went. After maybe 30 minutes of relentlessly powering through the woods, I crested a low rise and caught a flicker of motion through a stand of lodgepole pines, maybe 300 yards out. It was the hiker. It had to be. This lanky figure in what looked like a camouflaged hunting shirt, trudging along with his head down like he had no clue that he was headed toward disaster. I cupped my hands and shouted,
"Hey! Evacuation order! You gotta get out of here!"
The wind dampened my voice, but he heard me, and although he stopped and turned for a second or two, he simply turned around and just carried on walking through the woods. I just cursed under my breath and then started to close the gap, jogging where the ground allowed me to until I was certain that I was within earshot.
"Hey!"
I called again breathlessly.
"This area's being evacuated! Wildfires! You gotta head west for Forest Road 64, now!"
I was about 50 yards away from him by then, and once again he stopped but didn't turn. I expected a hiker, a camper, someone ordinary. But what I saw clawed at the edges of my sanity, and even now, I honestly don't know if it was real or if the combination of grief and isolation had finally caused something inside of me to snap. The man didn't look like a hiker. In fact, he looked very, very sick. As my jaw dropped and my eyes widened into what must have been huge, horrified circles, I realized the man was bare-chested. The reason it looked like he was wearing camouflage was because his skin was a mess of thick, dark scabs and bulging, glistening boils that seeped green-yellow pus. And his torso heaved with each breath, these sores pulsing as his chest rose and fell, and as I looked at him, all I could do was freeze, dead in my tracks. Was my mind playing tricks on me? Had that grief and solitude and the endless hours staring off into the unchanging horizon worn down my mind? Or was that nightmarish sight standing before me actually real? I remember asking if he needed medical attention and mentioned that I had a first aid kit with me. But my overarching memory of that exchange was hearing my own voice just cracking with fear. I was on the verge of being overwhelmed with shock and confusion, but the man didn't flinch. He just stood there with his back to me, head slightly cocked like he was listening to me. And as he stayed quiet, I felt a cold sweat forming on my neck, and I remember muttering, "Is this real?" to myself. But the details were too sharp, too vivid for my mind. If it was a hallucination, then I had no idea that they could feel that lucid. And I remember being gripped by this combination of terror and confusion as the man turned. The skin on his face, chest, and bald head was identical to that on his back. All these boils and scabs that looked incredibly painful. And then he just looks at me and kind of smiles. And his smile wasn't threatening, but it was deeply disturbing all the same, and even from 15 to 20 feet away, I could see that his teeth were missing. And yet despite the terror clawing up my spine and this revulsion in my gut, despite being completely convinced that I was suffering some kind of sudden and severe mental illness, all I sort of felt was peace. It was like an odd, out-of-body experience or something. I knew what was happening was all wrong. I knew that I should be terrified. But all I could feel rising up in my chest was the sensation of bright, bubbling joy. Like I'd found out that no matter what was going to happen in my life, everything was going to be okay. I felt myself begin to smile. And as I did, the man's smile widened and let out a short but unmistakable chuckle. I suddenly felt as if I wanted to laugh, to double over and cackle, even as my mind screamed at me not to. It was like I'd lost control of myself. I couldn't move. I couldn't speak. All I could do was feel while staring back into the man's small black eyes. I was convinced I'd lost my mind, that the internal monologue that went through my head in those moments were the last sane thoughts I'd ever have. And then just when things seemed like they couldn't get any stranger, they did. The boiled, covered man opened his mouth and a whisper slipped out. It was too faint to catch, little more than a hiss beneath the wind, but then somehow his words came out of my mouth. "Go home," we said together. The words weren't mine. I hadn't thought them. Hadn't meant them, but I said them. Yet before I could really think about what had just happened, I was turning around and walking away, back in the direction of that lookout tower without ever once turning around to look back at that man. I didn't want to leave him there. I didn't want to stop staring at this impossibility. But at the same time, I couldn't stop myself from walking away, and nor did I want to. And my head was spinning the whole way back. Hallucination or not, what I'd seen felt way too real, and since I'd never experienced anything like it, I was terrified. It's difficult to describe, but it was like the strange sense of involuntary joy that I felt still lingered. And I only felt truly in control of myself again when I climbed the tower's steps, hands shaking as I locked myself in the cabin. Through the windows, I scanned the forest, half expecting to see the boil-covered man lumbering up the stairs after me, but there was nothing but trees. I grabbed the radio, thumb hovering as I began wondering if the man had been there at all, or if I'd whispered, "Go home," to no one but myself. Following my encounter, or whatever the hell it was, I couldn't shake the feeling of unease that settled over me. And for almost 2 months, the cab had been my refuge, my home. But after the events of that day, I felt trapped. I spent the night awake, jumping at every creak of the cab, peering out the windows into the dark, half convinced that I'd see that boil-covered man climbing the steps. And by morning, the forest was still, but I couldn't trust what I saw anymore. And if I couldn't trust myself, I knew I had to get out of there. I grabbed the radio, steadying myself as I thumbed the transmit button. Then I just told them the truth. I told them that on mental health grounds, I was no longer fit to continue the season. Then when they asked for more specifics, I told them that I thought I'd been seeing things. There was a pause, long enough that I wondered if the signal had dropped. Then the ranger's supervisor got on the line and asked what I meant by seeing things. And again, I was just 100% honest with them. I told them exactly what had happened with the boil-covered man, that the experience had left me extremely shaken, and that I believed that I needed to seek treatment as soon as possible. There was another pause, and then I heard the supervisor's voice soften through the static. And he told me they took that kind of thing very seriously. The only issue was they were stretched too thin to get me a replacement immediately. The supervisor asked if I could last another 24 hours while they found another lookout, and when I said yes, he told me to hang in there, and then ended the transmission. I tried to stick to the routine for one last day, scanning the horizon, logging weather, sipping water to stay sharp, but every shadow in those trees made my pulse spike. Headquarters checked in on me every so often, so I kept the radio close, but that night, I avoided the catwalk, afraid of what I might see below. Sleep came in spurts, and I was jolted awake by strange dreams. And then, first thing in the morning, the call came.
"Table Rock, this is Ranger HQ. We got a replacement. They'll be over this morning. You're good to clear out after handover. Over."
And relief hit me like a wave, though it was tinged with this sharp sense of unease. If what I'd experienced was indeed a hallucination, suffering another while on the drive home could probably be fatal. See something in the middle of the freeway, swerve to avoid something that's not even there, and that might be the end of me. The thought was still on my mind a few hours later when I spotted a Forest Service truck in the distance kicking up dust as it rumbled down the forest road. My replacement was a ranger in her 40s, all business with a clipboard and a nod. I walked her through the cab, then, as I handed over the keys, I felt my hands shaking. The ranger asked if I was okay, and I just told her that it had been a rough stretch, and she chose not to press any further. After the handover, I grabbed my pack, took one last look at the tower, and then climbed into the car. I didn't glance in the rear view as I drove away. I just wanted to be gone. And about a week later, I was sat in a psychiatrist's office, staring at the beige carpet with hands clenched in my lap, mentally rehearsing what I was even going to say. And then when it was time, I told the doctor everything, from my mom's death to what I'd seen in the woods. She listened and jotted notes on a pad. And then after confirming that I'd been clean and sober during my time as a lookout, she told me what I'd experienced sounded a lot like a stress-induced hallucination, which apparently are surprisingly common following a sudden loss like that. She said my brain was misfiring, turning guilt and sadness into something I could see, and she then asked if I blamed myself for my mom's death. I didn't answer right away. I hadn't been there when it happened, and that ate at me. Towards the end of the appointment, the doctor suggested a brief course of medication, something for anxiety and sleep, and therapy to process the grief. Then over the next few weeks, I started to feel a little better. But I only felt much better about Mom's sudden passing, and somehow, despite all the pills and therapy sessions, what I'd seen out in those woods didn't feel any less real. I told the psychiatrist about it at the follow-up, and he said it was my mind holding on to the trauma. I hadn't been to many therapy sessions, so he continued to push for that, claiming that talking might help me let it go. I nodded, but mentally I didn't commit. Logically, I guessed it made sense. Grief plus stress equals brain glitch, but part of me wasn't convinced. My memories of the man and how I felt in his presence didn't feel hazy, scattered, or out of sync. And even all these years later, I can still remember him like it was yesterday. I've been a forest ranger for 8 years now, and for the past 5 summers, I've been stationed at a fire lookout in the Pacific Northwest. Most folks at HQ just call me the loner, with a good-natured chuckle. You see, I'm a single man, always have been, and I reckon I always will be. There's a certain freedom in that, a kind of simplicity that I've learned to enjoy. Summers up in my lookout tower are where I feel most at peace, surrounded by nothing but the endless sweep of pines and fir stretching out beneath me. And the tower is my weathered wooden perch, perched high on a rocky ridge with a wraparound deck and windows that give me a complete view of the surrounding forest. It's just me up there, with nothing but my stack of dog-eared paperbacks, some beat-up coffee pot, and the soft crackle of my radio that I use to communicate. I really don't mind the solitude. In many ways, I like it. You just can't find peace like that anywhere else. The way the wind whispers through the trees and the way the sun paints the sky with orange and purple as it sets, it's tranquil, almost sacred to me. And out there, I'm not just an observer. I'm a part of nature. And it really does make you a poet out there with only your mind to think. But there was one summer a few years back when something really shook me to my core. An incident that I'll carry with me until the day that I die. It started like any other season. In early June, I hauled my gear up in the winding trail to the tower. Canned goods, a few fresh shirts, my rifle, and a journal that I sometimes scribble in when the mood strikes me. The forest was alive with chickadees jumping between branches, along with the chatter of squirrels and the occasional thud of a pine cone hitting the ground. I settled into my routine, spending mornings at the desk, scanning the horizon for smoke, while just logging wind speeds and temperatures for the daily report. And for the first few weeks, it was paradise, same as always. Then, about a month in, something changed. I couldn't pinpoint it at first, it was more a feeling than anything concrete. I'd be out on the deck, sipping my coffee, and then suddenly, the hairs on the back of my neck would start prickling. The woods got quiet, too, almost unnaturally. No bird song, no rustling of leaves, just this sort of eerie stillness. I've been around long enough to know that the forest has its moods, but this felt way different, and I started to think that there might be a mountain lion in the area, possibly. There are ghosts out there, silent, solitary, and damn near invisible until they want you to see them. I'd found signs of one not too far from the tower a week earlier, a pile of scat and some claw marks gouged into a cedar trunk. So anytime I left the tower, whether to check the rain gauge or haul water from the creek, I slung my old Winchester bolt action over my shoulder. Nothing fancy, but she was reliable. That uneasy feeling, though, dragged on for weeks. I'd wake up in the middle of the night convinced that I'd heard something. It might be a twig snapping or a low growl. But when I grab my flashlight and sweep the beam across the clearing below, there'd be nothing. I started double-checking the lock on the tower door, something I'd never bothered with before, and during the day I'd just scour the ridge lines with my binocs and look for any hint of movement. But again, there was nothing, just trees swaying in the breeze with the occasional hawk circling overhead. My nerves felt frayed, but I told myself that it was just the isolation getting to me. You spend enough time alone out there and your mind can start to play tricks on you, believe me. Still, I couldn't shake that sense that something was out there, watching me. Then, just as mysteriously as it started, it stopped. The birds came back, their songs were filling the air again, and a family of deer wandered through the clearing one morning, nibbling at the grass while acting completely unafraid. The forest felt alive again, and for the first time in a long time, I allowed myself to relax. I've even laughed at myself a little, jumping at shadows, spooked by my own imagination. I still carried the rifle, but it felt more like habit than necessity. And things seemed back to normal again. Then one afternoon in late August, I hiked down to a creek about a half mile from the tower to check the water level. It's a peaceful spot, where the water winds through mossy rocks under the shade of nearby pines, and I was crouched by the bank, scribbling a note in my logbook when I noticed my bootlace had come untied. The last thing I wanted was a trip hazard during my return journey, so I set my rifle against a rock and bent down to retie it. I was still fumbling with the lace when I heard it. A sharp, sudden thwack, as something struck the tree behind me with a massive amount of force. I turned around, and there it was, an arrow buried deep in the bark. It had missed my head by inches. Panic hit me like a runaway freight train. I didn't stop to think. I acted entirely on instinct. I grabbed my rifle and ran, boots pounding the dirt, branches clawing at my arms as I tore through the brush as fast as my legs could carry me. My lungs were burning. My pulse thundered in my ears, but I didn't even think about slowing down until I was safely back at the tower. I remember bolting up the stairs, two at a time, then slamming the door behind me before I turned the lock. My hands were still trembling as I took up a position by the west window, peering out at the tree line with my rifle at the ready. The forest looked still and calm, but I wasn't fooled. Someone had just tried to kill me. I fumbled for the radio, almost dropping it, and keyed the mic.
HQ, this is Lookout 7,
I said, alarmed at the terror in my own voice.
Someone just tried to shoot me with an arrow, and they're still out there. I need backup now.
I remember how a ranger's voice came back in moments, sounding calm but very urgent.
Copy that, Lookout 7,
he said.
Sit tight. We're sending a team your way.
I stayed by the window, my rifle at the ready, eyes darting between the trees, and every shadow seemed like hidden danger, while every dull noise sounded like a footstep. It took an hour for backup to arrive, but when it did, three armed rangers piled out of a dusty jeep, scanning their surroundings as they did so. I met them at the base of the tower and led them back to the creek. My legs were still shaky from my run back to that tower, and I can safely say that the walk back down to the creek was one of the most terrifying and unnerving experiences of my entire life. Someone had hunted me, and had almost killed me in the process. But during that walk back to the creek, it was us that were hunting them. Not an animal, but a person. When we arrived at the creek, the arrow was still there, lodged in that tree. Everyone went quiet, and we fanned out to search the area for tracks of broken branches, anything to tell us who had been there or where the shot had come from. But we found nothing. The ground was a carpet of pine needles, too soft to hold a footprint, and the shooter had not left a trace. One of the rangers yanked the arrow free and studied it. It looked handmade, but the question of who made it was anyone's guess. Someone suggested that it might have been a poacher. Maybe someone who hated the federal government for whatever reason, but even so, his tone lacked any conviction. And they stayed with me for 2 days, taking shifts on the deck, rifles ready, but nothing happened. No more arrows, no signs of life beyond the usual forest critters, and whoever shot that arrow at me had just melted away, leaving us with more questions than answers. The rest of the summer just dragged on. Uneventful, but tense. I'd sit up most nights, staring out into the dark, the rifle across my lap, waiting for something that just never came. The forest I loved felt different now, like it was hiding secrets I'd never get to the bottom of. I finished the season, packed up my gear, and hiked out just as the first rain started to fall. The whole thing doesn't haunt me or anything, but even now, years later, I can still hear that arrow snapping into the tree, and I remember the cold dread that dripped over me in the seconds afterwards. I still work the towers, still love the wild, but there's a part of me that always is looking over my shoulder, wondering who was out there that summer, and why they tried to end my life. I'd been a forest ranger for about 6 years when everything with Ted happened. It was summer of 1997, and I was still pretty green compared to him. Ted was the guy everyone looked up to. 30 years on the job, steady as a rock, the kind of man who could stare down a grizzly and not even blink. He was in his late 50s then. He was wiry but strong, with a graying beard and a voice that seemed to demand people's attention. We all respected him. Not just because he's been around forever, but because he had this way of making you feel like he had everything under control. Ted was like an uncle to us. Gruff but warm, always ready with a story or a piece of advice, and boy did he love the fire lookouts. Every summer, he'd volunteer to man one of the towers, spending weeks alone with nothing but the forest and a radio for company, and he said it was the only place that he could really think. That year, he'd gone out to the tower in the northwest corner of our national forest, a spot called Hatcher's Point. It was remote, about a 2-hour drive from the ranger station, with most of the journey being on winding dirt roads that turned to mud when it rained. The tower itself was a squat, as they say, this wooden thing perched on a rocky outcrop. I'd been up there once or twice myself, and it was so peaceful that, in a way, it made you forget the rest of the world even existed. Ted had been out there for maybe 3 weeks by mid-July, checking in daily with the station like clockwork. His voice would come in over the radio every morning, saying stuff like, "Hatcher's Point, all clear, weather's holding," and that was Ted's style of speech in a nutshell, short, to the point, and reliable. But then, on July 21st, everything changed. It was late afternoon when his call came in. I was at the station with a couple of other rangers sorting through maps and drinking terrible coffee when the radio suddenly burst into life. And a split second later, Ted's voice came through the static, very sharp and panicked in a way that I'd never heard before. "This is Hatcher's Point," he said. "I got a fire that's coming in fast from the southwest. Winds are picking up. Might have to evac." There was a pause. Then, quieter, "It's moving too quick. I gotta move." And after that, the transmission went dead. We scrambled into action. A fire that close to Hatcher's Point wasn't something we'd seen coming. There had been no lightning strikes reported and no signs of smoke on the horizon that morning. But Ted didn't panic over nothing. Within an hour, we had a crew mobilized, and I was part of the team sent to scout the area from the ground while helicopters flew overhead. And by nightfall, we could see the glow of flames chewing through the forest. It was a nasty one. Dry conditions and a stiff wind had turned into a real monster. The fire tore through the ridge near Hatcher's Point, swallowing trees and spitting out plumes of smoke that blotted out the sky. We assumed Ted had made it out. He knew those woods better than anyone, and in all likelihood, he'd taken the access road and headed back toward the station. The fire burned for 2 days before we got it under control. Then, when it finally died down, the area around Hatcher's Point was this charred, smoking mess. There were acres of blackened stumps and ash with the ground still warm, but the tower itself was gone, reduced to a complete pile of beams. Ted's truck was still parked at the trailhead, which didn't sit right with us. He should have driven out, or at least left a note, but there was no sign of him. We figured that he'd hiked out on foot, maybe gotten turned around in the chaos. He was due back to the station hours after he called in, but when a full day passed with no sign of him, the head ranger called for a search and rescue effort. I was on the team that went looking for him. There were 8 of us, plus a couple of dogs, fanning out from the trailhead as we kicked up clouds of ash that stuck onto our boots and pant legs. We called out Ted's name, our voice echoing around that dead valley, but apart from the occasional creak of a branch giving way under its own weight, the forest just stayed silent. I remember thinking how creepy it all looked. Nothing but miles of devastation. No birds or wind, just this overwhelming sense of death pushing down on us. We found him late that afternoon, almost by accident. One of the dogs started barking, pulling its handler toward a narrow ravine about a mile from where the tower had stood. I was close enough to hear the guy shout, and I remember running over with my heart pounding, praying for the best possible outcome. Ted was down there, sprawled at the bottom among the rocks and fallen trees. He was alive, but barely. Both his legs were bent at wrong angles, and the bones snapped clean through. His face was smeared with soot, and his eyes were wide, darting around like he was still scanning for danger. He didn't seem to recognize us at first. He just kept muttering under his breath, but I couldn't make out exactly what he was saying. We got a stretcher down to him and hauled him up, but that's when he started vomiting. It came up in thick, black spurts, splattering the ground like motor oil, and the smell was sharp and bitter, like burned meat mixed with some chemical. It was so bad that I had to turn away. We radioed for a medevac, and by the time the chopper landed, Ted was slipping in and out of consciousness as his breath became more and more shallow. They flew him to the nearest hospital, and I didn't see him again until a few days later when the head ranger asked me to come along while he talked to him. Ted was propped up in a bed in the ICU, hooked up to an IV and looking 10 years older than he had a week ago. His legs were in casts, and his skin was still this grayish, like the life hadn't quite come back to him yet. Our head ranger sat down beside him, and after some small talk, he asked what happened. Ted's voice was weak, but he didn't hesitate. And although this probably isn't exactly what he said, it's definitely the gist of it. "I saw something out there," he said, and he was staring at the ceiling as he said this. After the fire passed, I went back to check the tower to see what was left. The ground was still smoking and there was ash everywhere. And then I saw it. It was big but thin, like a starved, diseased bear. Its skin was all black, burned-looking, hanging off of it like it'd been cooked. It was eating the ash, scooping up with its paws and shoving it into its mouth. Our head ranger, Bill, shifted in his chair, and I felt like the hair on my neck was standing up, but Ted kept going. He said, "I couldn't move at first. I just stood there watching. Then it turned its head, and I swear it looked right at me. No eyes, just holes, but I felt it see me. And I ran. Didn't think, didn't look back. And the next thing I know, I'm falling. My legs are gone under me. And I don't remember much after that." Bill didn't say much, he just nodded and told Ted to rest. But I could tell he was rattled. Ted wasn't the kind of guy to make up stories. He didn't drink, didn't mess with drugs, and didn't even like telling tall tales around the campfire. And then there was the black stuff he'd thrown up. The doctor had pumped his stomach when he got to the hospital and they found something strange. Chunks of burned bark and partially digested mixed with a near-toxic amount of tree ash. They said it was like he'd been eating it, though they couldn't figure out why. Ted didn't offer an explanation either. He just shook his head when they asked, like he couldn't find the words. And he was in the hospital for weeks, long enough for his legs to start healing, and when he got out, he told Bill that he was done. 30 years in the service and he was retiring, effective immediately. We threw him a party at the station that fall. Nothing fancy, just some burgers and beer. A cake with "Happy Trails, Ted" written in blue icing, I remember. He showed up in a flannel shirt and jeans, leaning on crutches, and he smiled and laughed with everyone like it was old times. He even made a little speech, thanking us for all the good times and saying that he was looking forward to fishing and fixing up his old log cabin. But there was something off. I noticed it when I caught him staring out the window at the trees beyond the parking lot. His smile didn't reach his eyes, and his hands gripped the crutches so tight his knuckles went white. It was like he was waiting for something to come out of those woods. I asked him once, a few months later when I ran into him in town, if he was okay. And he said he was fine, but his voice was flat, and he didn't look at me when he said it. Ted moved out to that cabin of his about an hour from the forest boundary and kept to himself. I heard he still fished sometimes, but he never came back to visit the station. The last time I saw him was in 99 at the grocery store. He was thinner, his beard gone white, and he moved slowly, like every step hurt more than just his legs. We talked for a minute, and he seemed cheerful enough. He asked about the crew, told me that he'd caught a big trout the week before, but when I mentioned Hatcher's Point in an offhand comment, his face changed. His jaw tightened and he looked past me, out the store window toward the mountains. Then, quiet enough that I almost missed it, he told me, "Don't go up there." Then he turned and sort of hobbled off down the aisle. I never found out what he really saw that day. Maybe it was fire, the smoke, the pain messing with his head, and maybe he ate the ash out of delirium, some kind of survival instinct gone wrong. The doctors never had a good answer for that part, but I know Ted, or I knew him, and I've never shaken the feeling that whatever he ran into out there wasn't just his mind. Something followed him back from that ravine. Something he couldn't leave behind no matter how far he got from the forest. And I think it stayed with him until the day he died. Hey friends, thanks for listening. Click that notification bell to be alerted of all future narrations. I release new videos every Monday and Thursday at 9 p.m. EST, and there are super fun live streams every Sunday and Wednesday night. If you got a story, be sure to submit them over at my email, letsreadsubmissions@gmail.com, and maybe even hear your story featured on the next video. And if you want to support me even more, grab early access to all future narrations and bonus content over on Patreon, or click that big join button to hear about the extra perks for members of the channel. And check out the Let's Read podcast, where you can hear all of these stories in big compilations located anywhere you listen to podcasts. All links in the description below. Thanks so much, friends. And remember, this was an enriching therapy session.